From Ottawa, Canada. That's the Soul Jazz Orchestra with Mojuba. It's from their 2007 album. It happens to be their second album, Freedom No Go Die. Their distinctive sound, combining several different genres, serves as the platform for their political and message music. As one music critic put it, think of James Brown meeting up with Tito Puente, and they all meet up at Fela Kuti's house to jam. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And the program I hope you'll find useful today, although we start out with something quite jarring indeed. Paul DiRienzo, who has been reporting on America's Fukushima here on Lead Stories, the series dealing with the actual and looming disasters of America's nuclear program and at several nuclear looming disasters at its power plants across the nation, is here to discuss with us a massive leak at the notorious Hanford site, a sprawling nuclear reactor complex on the Columbia River in south central Washington state. This came to light literally recently, and regulatory agencies are insisting, however, there is no cause for alarm. But Paul, I remember you devoting a substantial amount of time talking about the Hanford site. And even then you said that it was not if this was going to happen, it was simply a matter of when. And not only that it was going to happen again, but it was going to be happening again at a catastrophic level. Your words have come to pass, it seems.
Well, at this point, it seems that a very dangerous situation has definitely occurred at Hanford, an unexpected and dangerous situation. The fact is that toxic waste that we're talking about, which is in a one of the numerous tanks there, and forgive me and check up the numbers, but sometimes when I'm live, I don't have everything in front of me, and the exact numbers are here and there, but I'll give you a pretty rough idea. There's 53 million gallons of waste in 27 double shell tanks. Those double shell tanks were built in the 1960s in order to contain the 53 million gallons I was speaking of that were originally kept in single shell tanks built during World War II and afterwards in order to store the waste from the reprocessing of uranium into plutonium nuclear fuel, which is used in atom bombs. The Hanford site is probably, should be most known, I don't know if it is most known, as the place where the plutonium for the first atomic bomb ever fired, which was at the Trinity site. It was called the Gadget, and it was exploded in July of 1945. And then that plutonium was used for the third atom bomb. The second one dropped on a city, the city of Nagasaki, Japan, on August 9th, 1945, killing approximately 60,000 people. After that, the site slowed down for a couple of years, and then when the Soviet Union exploded its first atom bomb in 1949, it was ramped up for massive production of up to 60,000 nuclear weapons until the last reactor was shut down in 1987. Since 1987, approximately 11, at its height, about 50,000 people worked there. It was a secret government-owned site. The city, the nearby city, was called Richland, Washington. It was a secret government city in which only recently information has been released as to what was even going on as far as the people living there. Richland is only recently been a city since the late 1950s, been a city where people actually even own their own property. Before that, it was government-owned and people just lived there, all the scientists and workers. After 1987, then the mode came from bomb production. It just switched from bomb production to cleanup. The cleanup, currently 11,000 people work there, and it is already 40, just on the cleanup alone, $40 billion has already been spent. and the United States Congress has it's a $3 billion a year for 100 years. So we're talking about, I think they're saying $120 billion over the next century. But, it could be way more than that before it's over. And even if it can be cleaned up in one century of billions of dollars a year's work. But it does keep everybody in Richland employed who's in that business. The companies that are involved with the cleanup is called Washington River Protection Solutions, and it is two companies really have combined together to form this organization. One is called initially called the Atlantic Richfield Oil Company. It has another name now, and it switched to nuclear waste production later on in its history as a company. And the other company is Energy Solutions, I believe, and it is one of two large companies in the United States that run nuclear waste dumps. And in fact, Hanford is the largest nuclear waste dump in the world and considered the most polluted place in North America. These companies are in charge of the tanks. Now, the original World War II tanks, they were filled with waste from the production of plutonium, which is, basically, let's give you some idea. Maybe to make nine gallons of plutonium nitrate, which is probably enough to make about one bomb, produced in those days, in the early days, and the system changed over time, produced about four tons, maybe 2 to 4 tons of waste for every 9 gallons for every bomb produced, and that waste could not. Much of it was dumped directly into the environment. It was dumped into the river, into the air, or just into injection wells, into the dirt behind the plant, or just dumped sometimes not just out on the ground. You know, they just let it run in the back. And the site is about the size of the state of Rhode Island. And after a while, it was so polluting that even the World War II era people who ran it, who really didn't care about the pollution, made a point that they didn't care. I mean, you could, if you brought up, nobody did as far as I know, but if you brought up one word of any problems you had with anything that was being done there, during the war, you would wind up with a draft notice on the front lines of the bloodiest battle of the war in about 5 minutes. And that definitely did happen. So you learned quick to shut up and not say anything if you lived in those days. Later on during after World War II, during the Cold War, they used there was 5 reprocessing plants. T plant was the first, and they had others. They used a different process that was slightly less polluting, and they would take the waste and actually keep it in big tanks. And these tanks, about 140 some odd tanks, were only single-celled shelled and were only really meant to last a few decades and began to rust out and leak like crazy. And you have to understand these contents of these, you know, that to make these people even care about how polluting they were, they had to be pretty polluting. They were pretty much destroying their own country by dumping it. It was washing up on the shores of Oregon and Washington. It was polluting and still pollutes the Columbia River. And in fact, besides these 53 million gallons are 200, square miles of pollution that they're dealing with, including huge underground aquifers of pollution underneath the desert soil where all that stuff collected over the years. And that is expected within a few years to actually reach the Columbia River and add even more waste to a river that supplies the drinking water for several large cities, including the city where most of the people who work at Richland live. So what happened was, one of these double-shell, more modern tanks where they had been moving the pollution or the radioactive waste from the old single-shell tanks into has sprung a leak. And it has sprung a leak in a way that casts doubt on the other 27 tanks. Each of these tanks contain about 800,000 gallons of waste. And you have to this waste was moved originally from the single shell tanks. The single shell tanks are still not out of the woods because they couldn't get all the stuff out. A lot of it is solidified in a gook at the bottom of the single shell tanks, and there's no plan right now. As a matter of fact, there's a danger to mix it in order to therefore liquefy it and then pump it out would actually risk the possibility of a nuclear explosion, because there's a possibility that you would have a criticality if the the plutonium and uranium and other things that are in that waste were to ever coalesce into a blob big enough to cause a criticality. You could have an explosion. I mean, that's a big fear, that possibility of that happening. It's a real possibility. And in the older tanks. Now, in the newer tanks, we're not supposed to leak. Now, one, it has leaked. Now, what had happened was the leak had been seen by investigators. Investigators had noticed the leak and several years ago, and it was reported to the government and the Department of Energy, which is the ultimate owner of the property, and they did nothing for 1 year. Mr. Geoffrey, who is the investigator, today, even in the last few days, has been in the news saying that I warned them and they did nothing, and they did nothing for 1 year. So eventually they found about several hundred gallons in a gooky mess in the inner the space in between the inner and outer tanks. That wasn't good. Then they started pumping out this tank, because at that point, when they realized that there really was this incredibly toxic substance, the deadliest substance known to man, leaking into the space between the inner and outer tanks, they claim it has not gotten into the environment. So as they started pumping it down, and they pumped 750,000 gallons out and left about a few thousand gallons still left in the tank, they noticed as they pumped the tank dry, it started to leak more. As it gets drier and drier, as the tank is almost emptied, all of a sudden, 8.5 inches of liquid appeared in the space between the two tanks. And then, that was yesterday, an alarm went off, alarming people that this was happening. Then, after they discovered 8.5 inches of waste in the space between the two tanks, they noticed that it settled 0.5 inch back down to 8 inches. Where that 0.5 inch of liquid went is a mystery still, and a frightening mystery at that. That is where we are at right now. Now, the government says it's under control, that nothing has gotten into the environment as of yet, but now we've gone from a double-layered tank to who knows how much of this substance. Of these substances, we really don't know what it is. It's such a mix of everything. They say that a sample of the substances inside these tanks contain every toxic chemical known to man in their radioactive form. And that's been said about them. Right now, they have pumps in the space in between the two tank shells. They've gone from double tank now. There's a single layer of metal now between the environment and this stuff. And they have put a pump in the space, and they're going to try and pump this stuff out. That's what they're doing now. But as I said earlier, it seems that as the tank gets lower and lower, the contents in the tank get lower and lower towards the bottom, that's when the leaking started and increased. So there's an unknown problem at work here, where as you, in an emergency sort of way, pump the contents of the tank out, it exacerbates the leak. So the reason for that is not known.
And this is happening with one tank, at least this is what they're admitting to now, that this is one tank.
Of the 28 that holds 800,000 gallons
and
each,
yet,
yes.
And there are almost 200 such tanks.
Well, 27,
the conditions of which
right.
could deteriorate similarly.
Well, that's what I want to clarify. Now, there was 140 single-shelled World War II era tanks. They were leaking. Many of them have leaked. Many of them have leaked. And leaked into the environment and are in the groundwater, in the river. They got in everywhere. The response was to take the contents of those tanks and pump them into newer double shell tanks. The double shell tanks, the modern tanks, hold all that 53 million gallons of waste, except for the gook they could never get out of the bottom of the single shell tanks, which is still there and still a major problem and could explode even as an atom bomb if they even mix it up to try and liquefy it to get the gook at the bottom out. The vast majority of the 53 million gallons are in these modern tanks that were supposed to never, ever leak. They were modern double-shelled stainless steel tanks, not World War I era primitive single-shell iron tanks. And in fact, now they are not only leaked, this one tank is leaking, but the mechanism of the leak as it's understood, which is poorly understood, could be repeated in the other 27 tanks. They have currently pumped most of the waste out of the tank that's leaking now. It's only a few thousand gallons left. But what they've discovered is the act of pumping out the tank causes it to leak more. The scientific understanding of this is poor.
Could you, Paul, give us an understanding of the level of toxicity? Now, it sounds like, well, it's just a little bit of stuff, and
everybody knows. It's beyond that.
This is what they're saying. But could you give us an idea of just how toxic this waste is, which is
It's enough to kill every human being on the face of the earth. If it could be equally, if we were lining up everybody and injected them with their share of it, it would kill everybody on earth. Easily.
What is the danger now as these tanks, at least this one tank, and people are unsure, it seems, about the conditions of other tanks? What is the position of the federal government, which owns the land and which has the full jurisdiction over
this? Well, the
this
private company, yes, upside. They own it. Yes, the United States government owns it. The Department of Energy, which is that part of the United States government that deals with all nuclear weapons and the waste cleanup from the nuclear weapons projects that we did, 60,000 weapons were built, owns the space. However, the actual cleanup is done by a company called Washington River Protection Solutions. That company is a combination of two companies. One is a former oil company that now does toxic waste and nuclear waste remediation. And the other company is an owner, one of the two large companies in the United States that runs the nuclear waste dumps that are allowed in the United States right now. There are several private nuclear waste dumps. One of them is called WCS, which is a company based in Texas that is basically owned by and defended by a conglomerate that is owned by members of the Texas Republican Party, leadership of the Texas Republican Party. And there's a few other high-level and middle-level waste dumps that are owned by this other company, but their biggest waste dump in the country, the one that really is the granddaddy of them all, is in Hanford. And that's where it's leaking now. Now, this waste, the government has a multi-billion-dollar program to build a glassification machine, a gigantic machine. I've seen it. I've been there. It's as big as any building in New York City. It's gigantic. And it's not completed yet, and it was supposed to be completed by now, and it's not going to be completed, and it's not going to be in operation until well into the next decade, and it'll be another 30 years of operations. If everything works right, it'll be no time before the year 2050 before this waste is glassified, turned to glass, where it's more stable and therefore can be buried. And it's supposed to be buried at the government waste site called Yucca Valley or Yucca Mountain in Nevada. Now, you might know Yucca Mountain, the geological repository, which means underground repository, has been blocked by opposition from the people of the state of Nevada who refused to allow it to be built there. And this has caused a situation where there is no place to send this waste. So that, combined with tremendous technical difficulties that were unforeseen in the glassification, the turning into glass of the nuclear waste at Hanford, there's too many unknown products in it that react differently than were predicted with the glass, making it an unworkable solution. Even after this $15 billion machine was built, it's just sitting there useless on the desert. They have now switched the focus of the cleanup from the failed, who knows how many tens of billions spent, to now dealing with these tanks, which is more pressing emergency than trying to glassify the waste inside the tank. Now they're just dealing with leaks of the tank. That has been a major shift.
what has been the reaction within the environmental world? Is there something that they're demanding that the government do other than, quote, clean up the mess? But is there something specific that they have in mind?
It's good to have Ron Wyden, the senator from Oregon, is very involved in this. He, according to the last reports, wants the DOE to take a direct hand in it and bring in. I think generally what the public tends to want is for the people who made this mess, the Army Corps of Engineers, which ran the Manhattan Engineering District, what we call the Manhattan Project, that built the first bombs, and who created this mess in the first place, under General Leslie Gulk, you know, General Leslie Groves, and Lieutenant Colonel Mathias, who was the main person who ran Hanford. It was a totally military Army run. And that the Army, the Defense Department, the United States Army, and in particular the Army Corps of Engineers, which ran and built the bomb, really, should directly take over this project and run it like a military project rather than having all these private companies contract with the government to do it.
A leak of this size, and considering the potential impact, you talked about the fact that there's enough toxic material there to kill every person on the planet. Is there an international agency that is compelling itself to be involved here as some kind of a mitigating force, considering that the project seems to be completely within the hands of the government, which obviously cannot be trusted to handle this?
The government is the government. I don't see how you can get any higher than the Department of Energy. That's about as high as it gets. So I don't see how you could get any higher than the Department of Energy. However, it is. The government already has it. But the general feeling that I get from talking to people is that the big problem is this. This is all for show. First of all, it hires 11,000 people who wouldn't have any other job any other way to do this cleanup, right? And it keeps the Pacific Coast National Laboratory, a national laboratory in that region that keeps scientists and physicists and engineers employed who in the nuclear field who wouldn't not necessarily have a job, right? Because there isn't that much going on in the field except what the government is financing. And the general feeling is this is all a make-work project from day one, and that the government really sort of doesn't care. And if you go by past history and the past attitudes, the government really, and the Army and the defense establishment and the people involved in all this never really showed in any of the things I've read, in any of the history I've gone over, that they really give a damn, you know, what happens. This is all make work and show for the public media, and that the general fear is that as soon as nobody's looking, as soon as people like you, Utrecht, stop having programs like this talking about it, that nobody is going to give a damn, and it's just going to let it go into the river and into the sea, and nobody really cares. I mean, if you look at the original rationale for the Manhattan Project, I mean, you know, James B. Conant, who was the head of Harvard, you know, who was one of the chief people, his brother-in-law, who was the Secretary of War, I mean, his, you know, family, the family that, you know, the several rich old world families that decided to build the atom bomb in 1940, who controlled the U.S. education establishment at that time, at the pinnacle was Harvard University. They saw this entirely as, and the purpose of this whole project was American world conquest. I mean, James B. Conant said it many times, and he saw no problem with America conquering, taking full advantage of World War II and its to conquer the world and to put the world under total, absolute control of an American democratic dictatorship as opposed to communist or Nazi dictatorship. And that's all they really cared about.
I know you're going to be continuing to watch this, and as soon as you find something, of course, you've been following this issue for a very long time, and you have filed so many reports with us to educate us about this particularly toxic and just unacceptable byproduct of what you just said, the will to dominate the planet through nuclear power. And now these nuclear chickens have come home to roost, there's a continued dismissal of the horrific consequences of the U.S. nuclear program, but we will continue to follow the story as long as you are on the case here, Paul. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Rishi, for having me on.
All righty. We'll take a break and come back to The Burn. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. Bernie Sanders insists that his campaign is a, quote, revolution, unquote. Sounds great. And he's got millions of votes to back up that contention. But his actions increasingly suggest that it's something other than a revolution. And I have been asking the question for quite some time. What is this thing? Is it a movement? Is it a party in the making? Is it a concessionary thing that is going on, trying eventually to just invigorate the Democratic Party by appearing to challenge its comfort with the status quo, and to inject some kind of oxygenated blood in a dying party, or an increasingly irrelevant party? What is this thing? But in any event, I think it is way past time that we call Brother Bernie out and demand to know just what this is. Now, in the last couple of days and in the last couple of weeks, Sanders has basically said that he sees his run as a revolution, and the revolution of ideas, putting on the table a number of things that he felt the party had gone astray from. It had gone to the other side. It had gone too far right. So is this revolution about bringing the party somewhat left? Is Bernie Sanders basically trying here to get the Democratic Party to reform itself? And the price in exchange for that, he gets to get a couple of his ideas included in a national platform as part of a so-called consciousness-raising effort. What the heck is this? I just don't get it. I understand and appreciate that you have to have some kind of a unique appeal in a highly competitive and contentious election campaign. I get that. But he started out as positioning himself as an outsider. And we discovered, of course, he's not. He's not an outsider. He's running, after all, under the Democratic Party banner. So it means that he has some degree of loyalty and fidelity to the Democratic Party. Okay, that's interesting. But when you start talking about the fact that what makes you different, you start couching the stuff in ideological terms and trying to differentiate yourself from the run-of-the-mill, standard-issue Democratic Party member. You're saying that you're not. because you are a democratic socialist. Okay, so, but you're still running under the Democratic Party's banner against an establishment candidate. You couldn't get more establishment than Hillary Clinton. And you're not taking her on ideologically. You're just basically talking about, you know, points of difference, you know, just points of difference that you have, where you and Hillary Clinton have a little bit of different scales of disagreement. But I'm talking about the fact that what is troubling is the degree to which lately we're hearing about how similar they are as Democrats. And up until just yesterday, you get the clear message from Bernie Sanders and from his campaign that they're not looking for a dramatic upset here. What they're looking for is enough of a threat in terms of solid voter support to persuade the party to give a little. And I'm wondering, well, if that's the issue, why would you use a national presidential campaign to get that done? B, why would you run, in effect, a propaganda campaign trying to persuade voters and potential voters that this can lead to something entirely different from the Democratic Party that they have come to loathe, because it is only cosmetically different in many ways from the Republican Party? You're positioning yourself as a whole different approach, a whole different answer. And on the basis of Sanders' appeal, he is exciting people, and they are rewarding him and his appeal with their votes. So the question is Bernie Sanders really pulling a fast one here? And what, therefore, is the end game? I've been asking this for a while. What is the point here of his candidacy? And are people justified in demanding an answer from him, as I have been asking? What do you intend to do with all of these votes that you're getting, except to basically turn them over, as he has said? He has said that if he doesn't win the nomination, the party's nomination for the general election, he will have no problem supporting Hillary Clinton. And I can't, you know, I've had it with the contradictions. Let me put it that way. I've had it with Bernie Sanders seemingly taking one position and then indicating by his own actions and by his own words that it's not, as the Jamaicans say, it no go so. So I think it's time to call him out. And I think it's time to play some hardball with Brother Bernie, because I believe that the fix is in. And I think it is a legitimate question to ask whether this is a revolution or whether this is a devolution, you know, returning to the Democratic Party the power and authority that other people invested in you, giving it in turn to the Democratic Party, despite the fact that the people voted for Bernie Sanders because they didn't want to vote for the Democratic Party. They wanted to vote for somebody who genuinely said that he is about change, offering something completely different outside of the Democratic Party establishment. I think the time has long since passed. Now, we got to get some scores settled here with Bernie, And that we need to get him to answer the tough questions. And it is not enough simply to talk about planks. Planks you want included in a national party platform. I think we need to ask him whether he's, you know, this is a ruse of some sort. Whether you could really be serious and genuine by positioning yourself as outside of the establishment and yet at the same time playing very much within it, the parameters it has set. And even saying that you intend, no matter how this thing turns out, you intend to be a party loyalist. So on the basis of these things, it seems to me that he does not qualify for further support as a democratic socialist, as a leader of any revolution, because there is no revolution. Unless he intends to say, well, the revolution is really not about the party itself. You can't, you know, revolutionize the party, but I'm revolutionizing people's concept of their own power to cause change. All that flim-flamming really is increasingly annoying to me. And I think he has gotten away and is continuing to get away with a sympathetic reaction from voters who are very sincere. Latching on to what he says is what makes him so different from a Hillary Clinton, is that he has all of these ideals, which used to be, quote, democratic, with a capital D. That is to say, identified with the Democratic Party's political or ideological sensibilities. But I'm confused about what Bernie is trying to do here. What is he selling? Are you? Are you as confused as I am? Or have you beaten me to seeing the light? 888-874-4888. What should be done with Brother Bernie at this point? We see that a couple more elections are due, and before you know it, the summer will be here, the duopoly will be meeting once again and pulling off their varying versions of a charade. The Republicans are going, they've already planned the demise of Donald Trump. He is not going down easy. He is going to have some kind of a fight in him around this. But on the Democratic side, this supposed contest between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, when you really look at it, it's kind of losing its tinge as a genuine contest, ideological contest here. And it troubles me that the same formula is working for both of them, and that is the ability to attract voters to their ideological, so-called ideological leanings, and therefore to galvanize their position and advantage come voting time for the so-called delegates. But is Bernie Sanders, in my imagination, or is Bernie Sanders really part of the party establishment now? Is this revolution real? Are we just at the cusp of a moment here where we will see the repeat of that capitulation I started talking about, going back to 1984, 1988, and even in 2008 and 2012 with Barack Obama, Jesse Jackson and Barack Obama, where the expectations that fueled this groundswell of support brought these candidates to hugely important and high-profile positions within the Democratic Party. And that's where it seemed to be enough. That's just what they wanted, and they put a plug in it right when they reached that point. I don't think Bernie Sanders has been forced to explain his position about this revolution that he says he's waging. And I don't think that there has been enough of a demand for clarity here by the various constituencies that have climbed aboard and in support of his campaign. I think some hardball needs to be played right now with him, and he should not be given a free pass. He should not be given a free pass, because I can find nothing more odious, nothing more objectionable than the sincere desires of millions of people being transmuted into support for a horrible candidate, a cacistocrat of the first order named Hillary Clinton. Eric from Brooklyn, what are you thinking?
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
Great. I just wanted to make this comment. I begin from a premise that, you know, I think is appropriate. It's obvious to me that this whole charade is just that. It's a fraud, you know, because they exclude all the other parties. So how can these people believe in what they're asking you to believe in or what they're asking you to participate in when from the beginning, Bernie, Hillary, Trump, all of these people have agreed to exclude everybody else, you know? So you begin from there, and then you go on to the different parties. You go on to Bernie and Hillary. It's apparent that Bernie is going to hand off everybody that he's – it's all about participation, and you know. Hello?
Yeah, I'm listening. Do you think there's enough noise being made about this? Or people embarrassed? What do you think accounts for this, the unwillingness to really confront him on these issues and to get definitive answers from him?
It's about imagery. You know, America likes to promote itself as this beacon of light in the world, as the one, you know, and Americans in mass go for it. And they also want to believe it, regardless of the fact that we see things falling apart in America and all around us. You know, is this fantasy that we're holding on to that we won't let go? And because we won't let go of this fantasy, we won't address any of the problems. So people are participating in this because somehow psychologically they can't let go of it. You know, and to let go, they become so identified with, because you hear people, I'm a card-carrying Democrat, I'm a card-carrying, you know, Republican. What does that mean? They don't give a damn about you. So how could you be a card-carrying any one of these people, you know, any one of these groups? So people have just bought into it, and they've been so conditioned that it's become so much a part of their identity to be American in this, you know, fantasy way, and to be participating in this great process of democracy, that regardless of the fact that we know it's a fraud and we're going for all these extremists, you know, I mean, going for Trump or going for Bernie, because, you know, going for Obama, they're saying all the good stuff, right, that certain people want to hear. But the process they're engaging in from the beginning is a fraud, you know? So, and we know this. I mean, it's hard for people to say that if you're participating in this huge race, you know, if it's a basketball tournament and you have the Warriors who are the champions and you refuse to let them participate, you know, or you refuse to let the people who have gotten there participate, then obviously you're not really, you know, this is not some kind of race. This is already predetermined. You know, you have two groups that are going to do the same things that are put in front of you. And if you can't differentiate between that, then you know, this place is lost. So
is Bernie Sanders, is in your view, Is there any way that Bernie Sanders can rescue himself as regards his claim that this is a revolution that he's doing?
No, he's participating in fraud. And just like Obama, I dislike those people more. You know, I really can't stand those people who present themselves, because they're preying on the weakness of everybody else. They're preying on the weakness of the people who want so desperately to believe in something better than what they're experiencing. You know, so they're preying on the fragility, you know, of the mental state of Americans who really believe that things should change and who want more. And who otherwise, you know, if it wasn't for the Bernies, if it wasn't for the Obamas, they've gotten to their limit. So they might actually promote a positive change if they weren't, you know, they're waiting to get up off their seat and do something for themselves. Well, you have these people who constantly come right in the nick of time to rescue this capitalism, this democracy, you know, and to keep it in the hands of the wealthy, and they do that by deceiving them in the worst ways. So you have Obama, who deceived all these black people, and he's destroyed so many, you know, black people. He's destroyed so much of the gains that black people have had. And you have Bernie, who's now, because, you know, inevitably all of the loss is going to come to whites too. So all these poor white people are desperate, you know, and here's Bernie to rescue them from whatever. Well, and they don't want to buy into the fantasy. It's just, it's sick.
We'll see how people react to what you offer today, but I thank you for offering it and getting this conversation started. Thanks, Eric, for your call. From Philly, Clara, you're on the air.
Well, thank you, Yatrice, and hello, and hope things are going well.
Going as well as they can.
Yes. I agree. I was listening to the last caller and thinking, as I have been, you know, all along, about what he said. You know, the fact that people are not able or willing to do what you and others, including Gary and a lot of other people, like other very progressive people, are asking to do, and that is to give up, to agree, to give up the luxuries and the comforts, not only physically but emotionally and politically, and go for broke. I mean, the people who are holding on to Bernie and all the other politicians are in a comfort zone, and their comfort zone is that includes having a place, a comfortable place to live, or even an uncomfortable place to live, some predictability in their lives. And now, right now, what we need is to say, look, none of these people, let's risk confronting Bernie. I don't think it's worth it, because Bernie told me in his first debate who he was and what he stood for. When he said, people don't want to hear about your damn emails, that was it for me. Fortunately, I was trained to pick up on things early, pick up on what people were really saying early in the process. He showed himself to be a fraud at that moment. He's not going anywhere, I thought. He won't challenge this woman. And he's being very patriotic. Paternalistic by saying these people don't want to hear. What is he? How could he tell me what I want to hear? So I rejected him. There was something you said, something that you presented the other day regarding the Dred Scott case. I heard was one part of it that just stuck with me. Much of it did. It was wonderful, wonderful presentation. But when Dred Scott was traveling, and he was traveling through areas, they said, where he might have been helped. He might have gotten off his out of his buggy or a train or whatever he was riding on, and gotten help from people in the area, Do you remember that part where he didn't?
Yes.
And the speculation was why? Remember that? Oh, that stuck with me. It reminded me of the American people right now. It's risky to give up what you have, even if it's a paltry amount. The person said, perhaps he was thinking, well, at least if I'm in slavery, I have a place to live. It's not too bad. My job isn't that bad. The ambivalence of taking a risk is detrimental to the human spirit. I have quite a bit of I have more respect for the Trump followers and even Trump for putting up such a fight. I don't like the man. I don't like what he stands for. But that is one thing that I think that I know is important if you're going to have any kind of change.
Do you think Bernie Sanders his revolution is genuine? Do you think he's really genuine about this?
How can he be if he is saying he's going to turn over his votes to Hillary? That negates revolution. It's not about Bernie at this point. It's about the people who support him. A man came to my door, of course, unexpectedly, on Saturday. It was a young white, apparently college student. And he said he had these flyers of Bernie in his hand. And he was about, I opened the screen, the security door, and he was about to hand me a flyer of Bernie. And I said, you don't need to give me that. I said, I'm not voting for him or any of those people. Why are you? And he said, well, Bernie's a socialist. I said, what does that mean? He didn't seem to be able to answer me. I said, he says he's a democratic socialist. What does that mean? So since he didn't answer me, I went on to say Bernie had not addressed the basic issue as far as I'm concerned, and that is continuing wars. And that you can't have continuing wars and do all these other things he says he wants to do. It's totally impossible. And he had no comment. He's just blank. These people have no way of thinking. I said, what will you do if he turns over his votes to Hillary? I'll vote for Hillary. Why? I'm a Democrat. And he said, I'm a Democrat. That's all he could say to me. Blank. No way of, no thought. So the de-education.
Well, I want to thank you for adding your two cents to this discussion today, Clara.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for calling in today. That brings us to the end of our program. And, of course, throughout the week, we should return to this question because I maintain, and I started making this call early, if you will recall, we got to get some clarity about Bernie, and we got to come down on him like a ton of bricks. He should not at all be given a free pass on the notion that he's to be trusted as a so-called revolutionary who is a democratic socialist and sowing all the signs of internal contradiction. And I think we need to get a fix on this real soon. I regret that the progressive community seems unwilling to do so. Maybe it's because they think, well, look, given what we've got to work with, he's better than nothing. I would disagree. Sometimes nothing is actually better. You can reach me at leadstories, LEID stories at gmail.com. And I thank you always for the pleasure and great privilege of your company. We'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.